Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Ethics for a Changing World. If you could avoid dying, would you? Just completely avoid and escape death. In this episode, I had a really interesting conversation with Seth Villegas, who's a researcher focused on transhumanism, which we'll go on to explain a little bit in more detail, but especially how some transhumanists, they're trying to use technology to escape from death. And it's quite hard to get your head properly round the implications of a world where people don't die and don't have to die. And that's what we're going to try and do in this episode. And we cover quite a lot of ground. We firstly talk about Seth's work and his thesis on how transhumanism looks a lot like a religion, which is interesting for a very secular movement. Then we talk about the different methods that transhumanists are using to try to escape death. And we focus especially on, firstly, cryogenics, and then also on this idea of digital uploading, this idea that either you can somehow be uploaded to the internet, we don't really know how that would work, or that by scanning your social media accounts and your communications with people, that we could create something which would simulate exactly how you would behave. And that's a deeply upsetting and fascinating idea for so many different reasons. And we're going to get into that in the podcast. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast and subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And also share the episode with anyone who might be interested. Especially on Twitter, you can tag us on Twitter at Ethics Tech Pod or on Instagram at Ethics for a Changing World. Without further ado, on with the show.
Hi Seth, thanks so much for joining us today. How about you start by telling us a little bit about your own work?
Sure. So I'm currently a dissertation stage PhD student at Boston University. And I'm in a religion and science program, and I have a kind of peculiar specialty of studying a movement called transhumanism. Transhumanism is all about radically changing the human condition. And some of the biggest things in that area are life extension. So how do you get people to live longer? And the thing that I'm particularly interested in about transhumanists is that it's not just that they want to live longer, but want to live longer in some sort of machine-like way. Whether that's becoming some kind of a cyborg. So think of things like Neuralink. Imagine if you had, a really complex apparatus attached to you. Or imagine that you could just upload yourself into a computer. And so they're actively investigating how it might be possible to change humanity into something else altogether. And after that, we wouldn't be human anymore. We would be post-human. And so it's interesting because transhumanism is about the transition from the humanity to post-humanity, with the transhumanity in the middle. And so they're trying to get to that course of change such that we can really integrate technology into ourselves in a radical way.
And some listeners might be thinking that this is just a very tiny fringe kind of group. How big is this and how influential are these people?
I think it is important to note that transhumanists are a relatively small group. But I will say that the kinds of ideas that transhumanists have, I think have a little bit of a wider appeal than just to the specific group of people. So if we talk about them as kind of who are the card-carrying transhumanists? I think we'd be talking about someone like Max Moore. So Max Moore is a philosopher. He's done lots of essays and papers and talks about transhumanism. And he basically talks about wanting to evolve, right? And how it is necessary to kind of control the evolutionary process. And that's something that's going to continue indefinitely. And actually, one of the more recent comments that I've seen from Max Moore that I've been really interested in is that he doesn't want to be someone who's just talking about it as an ideology. But he's actually jumped in and gotten involved by being the president for the Alcor Foundation for a number of years. And Alcor is a cryonics. So cryonics is when you basically freeze yourself with the hopes that some future technology will be able to revive you. And I think that cryonics is actually one of the most interesting examples of the sorts of things that transhumanists believe, because as far as we know scientifically at this point, it doesn't work. Like, the technology doesn't work. So there's a number of experiments in the 1950s and 60s that just showed that mammals can't be frozen for more than a few days without drastically reducing their chances of being revived. So they did an experiment with squirrels where after a few days, they could only revive maybe half of them. And then the rate kind of drops off drastically after that. And so we're in this interesting situation in which there's a projected increase in technological capacity in medical technology to be able to overcome this kind of danger to ourselves of the freezing process. And so transhumanists believe that a person who's gone into a cryonics facility to be frozen is still potentially alive, even though, as far as we know with today's science, they're dead. And this is actually one of the most interesting things, is that because of that, you can't legally freeze someone who's still alive. And what I mean by this is the way that cryonics facilities are able to get their patients, as they term them, is someone has to be declared legally dead in a hospital. And what I mean by that is, you know, that's when a doctor comes and says, you know, okay, this person's dead, you know, clock it at this time and take them away. And so the reason they have to do that is because they know that freezing you would kill you. And so they can't, as a medical establishment, they can't release someone to be killed in that way, right? That's like similar to pulling the plug. And so we're talking about not just freezing someone who has like a terminal illness, like, for instance, like a life-threatening cancer, but reversal of what we know today as death itself is also something that they believe in. So we're talking about resurrection at that point, as far as our own definitions today go. And that's partially why I'm interested in it, is because you have a group of people, you know, again, very logical philosophers, mostly atheistic, who come to the conclusion that we can project some sort of future technological change that's going to cause this situation to be utterly different in the future than it is now. And there's lots of other people I could potentially go into. I think that Ray Kurzweil is probably one of the other big figures that I'll mention here. He's someone who works at Google. No one's really sure what he does. He's actually very famous as an inventor. Like, he invented like the synthetic keyboard, for instance. So we actually owe a lot of our tech to him. And he's one of the people, I think, pioneering digital uploading. He's really interested in that. What would it mean to live unimpeded as a digital life in which I can kind of control my avatar and be whoever I want? There's this famous, I guess I don't know how famous it is, but there's this video of him talking about wanting to, be a kind of, blonde pop star, right? And, you know, kind of singing and dancing like that. And it's really bizarre. But I think this is another core part of the transhumanist idealization of becoming digital yourself, is that you can control any aspect of yourself. And this idea of autonomy is all over transhumanist writing of, I want to be able to change myself in whatever way I can imagine. And the thing is that code is a lot easier to change than physical reality. And so why not become code? Why not take on that sort of a form?
That's really interesting, and we'll pick up some threads from there in a second. I just wanted to ask one more introductory question, which is, you have your own podcast. Why did you start your podcast?
Yeah, so I host a podcast called Digethics, about digital ethics. And part of the reason why I wanted to create that podcast is because, in part because of my own specialty in transhumanism, I'm often asking questions about technological efficacy, right, as we were talking about with cryonics, and the sort of interaction with human belief. And so there's this really, you need to know lots, you need to know a little bit about psychology, you need to know a little bit about religion, you need to know how technology works, you need to be able to read the science on things. And this is all actually really complex. And for the past couple of years, I've been working with Boston University's Computing and Data Sciences Unit, which is pretty new. And just looking at, well, how can we kind of get engineers, right, to understand the values part of it, right, where I would say it comes from the humanities, but also get non-coders and engineers to understand the technological part. And so the podcast is really aimed at, let's try to focus on how are the problems related to the how the technology works, and how are intentions kind of built into that? Because sometimes a technology works poorly because it's designed that way. For instance, there's this thing called dark patterns in which people, if you've ever been on a website or if you've ever used one of these, kind of bad phone games, where in which they have like little X to click on out of the ad, it always changes places or it doesn't let you click it right away, or it brings up, it does something that you don't want it to do because of the way the interface is designed. That's a result of intentional choices. And so having people understand the difference between those things and their kind of ethical implications, because designing something intentionally to get the user to do something they don't want to do is very different than designing something potentially poorly that doesn't work the way that you want it to do. And so kind of empowering, I think, engineers, and I think my real hope for the podcast is sort of like the next generation of coders and engineers will be conscious of the kinds of problems that came before, and that if we can develop case studies and help them to kind of analyze those things, they can kind of project out the implications of the sorts of things that they make with greater care than we can today, because in a lot of ways, we just didn't know what was going to happen, right? I'm sure the people who made Google as a search engine weren't thinking of the, you know, billion-dollar empire that would come out after that when they create something like that. And so helping us to understand that, and also I think helping people understand the business side of technology, I think is also really important. So that's what's kind of the impulse behind creating the podcast. And it's been really great so far just to talk to people about these kinds of issues. And I'm really glad we were able to get connected through it.
Fantastic. And yeah, I would really recommend listening to the podcast. It's really interesting. So I guess your overall thesis in your own research is basically, as I understand it, that transhumanism looks a lot like religion. It just takes on this kind of quasi-religious character. Could you just clarify what you mean by that exactly?
To understand what we mean by something is like a religion, we have to kind of think about what a religion does. And so, for instance, actually in the 70s, lots of atheist groups were unhappy because to leave the church, and I'm thinking of being like an American situation here, meant you were also leaving a community of people who you couldn't, you know, you couldn't really associate with those people in the same way anymore. And there wasn't some sort of an equivalent for atheists. And so what they would actually do is they would try to create similar things. And actually within the past couple of decades, you would see things like Sunday Assembly, which was headed by a couple of British comedians actually, who were like, well, why is it that only the Christians get to like get together on Sunday and, you know, eat tea and cake after they have like an inspirational talk? Like, that's not fair. They don't have a monopoly on that. And so what we'd say is those types of organizations are a sociological replacement for religion, right? So there's something that religion does, in this case, community, and then people find a way to do that without the religion-y part. But when we're talking about transhumanists, we aren't really talking about that as much. What we're talking about is that the kinds of beliefs that they have appear to take on similar psychological qualities to those experienced by religious people. And what I mean by that is, and I'm actually going to be using the new atheist a lot here, is there's certain kinds of like unfalsifiable beliefs. And what I mean by that is that because we can't know what's going to happen in the future, but we make claims about what's going to happen in the future, there's a way in which we can't really verify whether that's true or not. And the kind of a secular mainstream view is, well, if you're going to show something, just prove it, right? If you can prove it demonstrably scientifically, then I'll believe you. But similar to what I was saying about cryonics, they have lots of beliefs that seem to go against what even science has at the moment, right? So for most scientists, they're like, okay, this issue is settled. Right. There's no way you can freeze a person. That's just something that we know. Right. If you're in a science class, that's just something that you kind of understand. But they say, no, that science is wrong, though. Right. And we actually will be able to make transitions in the future. And notably, there actually have been some, what we call them, like advancements in techniques related to cryogenic freezing that have come out of cryonics facilities because they're kind of pursuing this when other people aren't as much. But they still haven't overcome the key problem, and we're not sure if they ever will, right? So it's kind of like an outsider who's not invested in the story that they're telling about freezing yourself and waking up in the future. It seems very implausible, right? But to them, I think they are very invested in the idea that this kind of has to work, right? Like, because if this doesn't work, then how do I get into the future? And this is actually the most interesting question I think there is with transhumanists, is that it's not just about technological advancement occurring in an abstract sense, right? Which is, you know, like we're here today and in 100 years we'll have, you know, much, much better technology. Transhumanists now are very concerned that they won't make it to that point. And so if they won't make it to that point, they have to think of these scenarios in which they themselves can be a part of that technological change, especially if it, you know, radically accelerates. And so they talk about something called life extension takeoff, which is the idea of, if I manage to extend my life by 10 years, right, you know, I'll live till, I don't know, who knows, right? But within that 10 years, if there's another advancement that allows me to live, say, 20 years, right, then as long as there's successive advancements in each of those little periods, you can kind of take advantage of all of them. But that's only relevant if you're worried about you yourself becoming a post-human. It's not merely about post-humanity coming at some point. And this is a big part about the debates of, should you directly intervene in the evolutionary process to change humanity, right? Say through something like CRISPR, you know, changing our genetic code, or turning us into machines, or making it so that we don't have bodies, we're just code, right? All that stuff is... whatever sorts of choices might be made in 2,000 years aren't really relevant to us unless, again, we're imagining that I will be there at that point to make those decisions too. And that's where I think the religious element actually is. It's in that, no, I have to get there. I need to be a part of whatever kind of change is going to occur, rather than just saying, no, we need technological advancement because of all the benefits that could come from it. And they do definitely say that, but it's the getting themselves there, that's the big thing.
That's really interesting. And it reminded me of, there was an idea that was big in the 70s and 80s, which has gone out of fashion because certainly there's some quite extremist examples of this view, but you've probably heard of accelerationism, which is it's this idea that we need to speed up modern life, be that capitalism, technological progress, and then we can make this breakthrough to a higher being. A higher kind of plane of being of humanity. It's a fascinating and also terrifying idea in its own way.
It definitely is. And, you know, there have been lots of futurist movements. You know, there's also been the Italian futurists. And it's just unclear, especially at a time like today, I think, you know, even the name of your podcast, right? Like Ethics for a Changing World is something that I'm always thinking about. And to see people who kind of want to charge ahead into that, as opposed to kind of being more cautious at a time of where change is already almost too rapid for us to keep up with. I think that's the part where we're sort of, I think I'm personally a little apprehensive about that. But I don't have the same kind of psychological investment in getting there either, right? I have a different, you know, view towards death than I think that they do, right? I'm not as, you know, like, and I think one of the interesting things is, you know, why preserve yourself, right? You know, so most people experience a kind of what we call biological immortality through their DNA, right? Like you have kids, right? You know, and so some part of you kind of continues to live on. But I would say for a lot of transhumanists, that doesn't seem to be enough, right? It's not enough for that genetic line to continue to understand your kind of part in the ongoing change of humanity, but rather the complete self-preservation that kind of gets me. And we'll kind of see where that goes in the future and if they'll hold on to that, but especially because a lot of transhumanists demographically are middle-aged, And I think this is really interesting of, I think starting to think about a lot about death and having the worries of that. And you'll have people take on really extreme diets, for instance, or take supplements, sometimes even very experimental supplements. For instance, there's a lab at Harvard that does life extension sort of stuff, the Sinclair lab. And so imagine if you're a transhumanist and you're reading something that could potentially extend your life, you might be interested in getting a hold of that, even if you have to do it through less than legal means. And so there's a little bit of a desperation there, maybe midlife crisis. I don't want to speak at that because hopefully I'm not at the middle of my life yet, but it's definitely interesting to sort of see that. And I think the demographics of that can't really be ignored either. And it'd be interesting to see if the kind of next generation of people will kind of take on that cause, or if maybe this sort of impulse will manifest in a different way.
Yeah, I was going to pick up on that, because do you think it's just a fear of dying, essentially? Or do you think there's more to it? Do you think it's a sense of they regard themselves as, I don't know, really important to humanity or something like that? What do you think it is?
Fear of dying is definitely a part of it. And one thing that they talk about is how the fear of dying should be pushing us into the arms of transhumanism. So if we really thought about that, someone like Max Moore basically say, within his atheism, there's only this world and this experience, right? There's no hope for an afterlife. There's nothing that's going to come after this. And so once I cease to live, I can no longer experience the world, right? The world just kind of disappears from me. But that there's no moral value that comes out of that disappearance. And so because of that, because this is all there is, for me to continue, is the only way forward is to extend my life, right? And there's nothing else, right? There's no other hope that's going to come along. There's no Messiah, right? There's no enlightenment. There's nothing. There's only these kinds of technological options for that. And so because of that, most transhumanists are very worried that other things that they see as, false promises, right? Like they think that religion, for instance, is a way of kind of getting rid of your death anxiety, right? It makes you not worried about it when you should be. They think that, well, if people did understand how bad it was not to exist, right, and to cease to experience, then they would be for our kinds of technological change. But they have all these other sorts of things going on that prevent them from feeling the same sort of anxiety. And so it's interesting to see how they kind of take on that death anxiety and like actually, dial it up instead of dialing it back. And again, if you see the kind of conflict that they have with other sorts of secular scholars and experts, people who are interested in, who are proud to be able to move on without desperation. This is something that Richard Dawkins talks about, for instance, is the difference between him and a religious person is that he's okay with dying. He doesn't need something to make him feel better about that, right? But the transhumanists come along and say, no, the dying part's really, really bad. You can't just accept that. And if you do accept that, there's no good that can come out of it. That's their position.
This is such a fascinating conversation. Before we get more into a couple of the things you said there, we've talked about how transhumanists are kind of, they want to hang on a bit longer until we get this miraculous technology that's going to make them live even longer, potentially, who knows for how long. What kind of technology do they have in mind, if anything, and why do you think they have such faith in technology?
So I would say there's three primary routes to immortality that they discuss. The first one is biological. So what kinds of supplements, for instance, can you take to better your biochemistry, right? So for instance, aging causes damage through wear and tear. And there's a famous transhumanist who works as a gerontologist, and gerontology is just the study of aging, who talks about, well, imagine that the body is like a car and a car has gradual wear and tear as it's used. If you could just repair the wear and tear, then you'd be a lot better off. And some of the things he talks about is, you know, things like free radicals, which is basically you have protons kind of floating around in you, which can be used for energy. But that also does damage at a cellular level, right? You can also have a degradation of mitochondrial DNA, which means you can't produce ATP as efficiently. And so there's lots of things at even a cellular level that if you're able to make sure that they go on long enough, right? Or for instance, if you were to extend telomeres such that cells would continue to reproduce, telomeres are basically this little bit of what used to be thought of as useless code, right? That doesn't actually get encoded into a protein. If that gets chopped off every time that a cell is reproduced, then it's eventually going to run out. But if you're able to maybe extend that such that they can continue to reproduce, that would be good. Ironically, they also look at something like the immortal cancer cells, right? So cancer cells are basically cells that don't have the stop reproducing thing turned off, right? Because every person has a kind of a body plan. And so cells are supposed to know by proximity to other cells whether they should keep producing or not. And so a cancer is basically a cell that continues making other cells, right? Even though it's detrimental to the body as a system. And so it's trying to, well, first off, observe the cancer and see like, well, how does it do that? Maybe there's a way we can do that. But in a way that's not destructive to the body is a very complicated question. The second path, I would say, is something we would call cyborg immortality. And that's like gradual replacement of the body. And actually, we've come a really long way in terms of prosthetics and how they're able to work and see even how they're able to kind of semi-mind read so that you can use them much easier. And I think something like that is gradually becoming more machine-like. And if you can imagine a story like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz, in which you just have like one limb replaced at a time, how far could you take that process is something we don't know. So could you have a completely mechanical heart? Could you have completely mechanical lungs? And transhumanists define most things purely based off their function. And so if you're able to design something that works, that fulfills a similar need, then that would be great. Something they also have been talked about is like a full head transplants, right? Like, would that be possible? And I think these are all a part of a kind of push towards like how much could you actually replace the body completely, especially because a cyborg body would probably be less vulnerable to accidents. And this is also something that transhumanists are very interested in, because if you're trying to live forever, it really sucks if you can get hit by a car and die, randomly, right? So what if you had a body that was more durable, right, that could avoid those certain things and that you could repair, right? And that's one of the benefits of, imagine if I was a machine that could just be repaired at will, then we don't have to worry about the sorts of biological things that come up. Then finally, the last one is, I would say, digital immortality. So that's, we get a little fuzzy here because no one knows how it would actually work, but there's a couple different ways in which they think that this could work. Well, one is called brain emulation. So we'll take like advanced brain scans and then upload that into a computer, and then the computer will be able to kind of reproduce it. The other one is actually sort of, you kind of synthesize a person from kind of like personal detail and other sorts of information to create like a model of that person that can then live in code. And this is actually very important for people who are no longer alive. So for instance, Ray Kurzweil talks about how he'd really like to synthesize a version of his father who's passed away using machine learning to go through all of his documents. He like composed things and to put all that data together into a new person, right? That could act and behave as his father. And what's interesting for Kurzweil is that he says that when it becomes indistinguishable to him as his father, right? When he would really be fooled that it is his father, it is at that point, right? Like you can't be fooled into thinking that it's someone, because what makes someone is merely the overall pattern of how it is that they behave rather than the continuity of their consciousness or something like that. And I think he thinks something like that because then you could get continuity of self across really fuzzy boundaries, right? Where it's like, maybe even if there's no uploading process, if you can somehow put together the profile of a person in a complete enough way that you can make a full-on version of it, then that would really be you at some point, right? As long as it's, you know, at like 100% fidelity or whatever. I don't even know how you'd measure that, right? But that's basically what they think. And I think that that's a really big issue right now, because if we don't know how to upload people, all you can do is synthesize data about your people, about yourself. And so there's this guy in Russia, actually, Alex Turkin, who he wears like an EEG helmet every day when he does work and stuff like that. He also, you know, kind of records lots of data on himself because he wants there to be a big enough record such that if the technologies of today don't get where he would like them to get, such that he could upload himself, that there would still be enough data for reconstruction, which I think raises a lot of interesting questions about what's usually called digital legacy, of what do you do with a person's data after they die, which is actually something we don't really understand yet as a society, right? So for instance, I had, unfortunately, I had a friend in high school who was hit by a car, but his Facebook profile was just still there, right? And it's like, well, what do you do with that? And, you know, you see people over the years kind of do sorts of remembrances on that. But if you can imagine someone living their whole life connected to the internet, and you have all this data accumulated on them, then there's this kind of this Hail Mary throw at a kind of digital reconstruction that could happen in the future because of the sheer accumulation of all that data on a single person. And I think that that's actually one of the most interesting ethical, practical ethical questions we have for today is, what is your relationship to your data, and what would it mean for other people to potentially use that in the future to create versions of you? Imagine, for instance, that people would be very interested in creating a Barack Obama, right? Or, you know, some other famous person just so that they could talk to them. But how can you consent? Like, you can't really consent to this reconstruction process in the future if you don't imagine that it's possible, right? But if that data exists, then people can use it however they want. There's lots of interesting questions about how that would actually work. And it's actually where I think theological questions can be helpful, because they raise similar kinds of concerns, right? Of how is it that you can think about consent in these sorts of weird resurrection, reconstruction scenarios that, you know, are just super weird, frankly, right? But how and why we relate to data is like the core question that gets back to you for me, because the fact that that's just everywhere. And for instance, you know, 23andMe, which is a, you know, the genome sequencing company, can just take your data and resell it, raises lots of practical questions, I think, on this area in particular of who owns that and why, and do you have rights to it, especially if it can be later related to your personality.
There was so much there that I want to pick up on. One of the things that you said was that a lot of transhumanists are interested in this idea of like a digital kind of avatar of someone that's already died. But that doesn't seem to solve the problem of their fear of dying. If we could assume that it could create like a reasonably good version of yourself that's like quite similar, it's almost a clone. It's not you. You yourself, in terms of the way that you as a person experience things, are still dead. But you, in terms of your traits and your personality, etc., are living on. But it's not you as you are that's going to experience that.
I'm really glad you're bringing this up, Patty, because I think this is one of the core philosophical objections to a kind of uploading scenario. And I wish I could bring up, you know, just random personal conversations I have with transhumanists, like as in my actual research, because I've talked to some transhumanists about this in person. And one person said, it would be enough if I could talk to the avatar and know that it was me, then I could die peacefully. And again, that's why I think we're getting to this interesting area of, why are you desperate to reproduce a version of yourself, even knowing that you might die, right? Like, it's your legacy, right? It's not you. You wouldn't actually continue on. And I honestly don't know, right? There's like a big question mark to me there. Because again, you'd think that having, say, children would also suffice, right? But there are people, I think, who are interested in direct clones, right? Like who want to reproduce themselves. And if you think of something like a clone, right, which happens, I think, in like Star Wars, right? Like Jango Fett like clones himself and then has a little mini me, right? And then kind of programs the child in that way to become something else. And I think that that's, yeah, sorry, I wish I had a more like coherent answer on that. But it seems to be one of the things that kind of pokes a hole in the sort of like, how can you construe that as immortality? But again, going to someone like Ray Kurzweil, who says that it is the holding of the pattern that is enough. And you can imagine it like if you have a file on a computer and you copy a file, right, from one computer to another and you delete the original, you would say, oh, well, the file's still there, right? Like, you know, the file's just on another computer now. But that's, you can't really do that with people as far as I know, right? But they're kind of postulating a sort of equivalence between those events of the, you know, copy and paste, and there's two of them, right? And then maybe eventually there's only one of them, right? But because they're identical at a certain point in time, then it's fine. And one of the other things I think is really interesting about this, which I think raises even more philosophical questions, is if you're able to recreate yourself in code, are you only recreating yourself at a particular point in time, right? At which you can only reproduce what you are at that moment, right? So like it's like a machine copy of you at a given age, for instance. And it kind of lacks the dynamism that would go along with being a flesh and blood person. But if you do create something that is dynamic, that could continue to have its own life afterwards, well, then those changes clearly wouldn't be a part of your personal history anymore, even if both were to continue to live. In Charles Stross's book, Accelerando, this is actually something that happens. There's two versions of a character. There's one character who lives on, you know, as their normal self, and they kind of have life extension efforts, and they kind of continue on forward. But then there's a digital version of the same person who has their own history and is like a crime boss doing all sorts of things. And so what's funny in that book is the person comes out of a cryogenic freezing and then is arrested for crimes done by their digital self, right? So it, you know, these things can get really bizarre really quickly. And I think that science fiction authors have already done a good job of kind of like thinking about the kind of weirdness that would come from that scenario. But the kind of continuity of those two different things, I think, is very, very suspect for exactly the reason that you put forth. And as you put more pressure on that kind of argument, I think the more suspicious it becomes.
And there's a version of this idea of a digital afterlife, which would probably seems like not that far off. Like there's companies like Eternine, I think is how you say it, who are working to create like a digital avatar of yourself. I mean, there's a Black Mirror episode which is very similar to this, but basically you just analyze someone's social media. If you analyze enough data, you can create a social media version of them that's pretty much indistinguishable.
Yeah, and that Black Mirror episode I think is really telling, because what happens in that episode is you end up having a company who offers a service to reproduce someone. And actually, there are examples of people creating chatbots of people who have died and moved on. So for instance, actually someone I know, Muhammad Ahmad, created a chatbot of his father because he was worried that his children would not get to meet their grandfather. And so he created something that they could interact with. And Eugenia Kaida is another person who created something similar for her friend who passed away and created an app that people could chat with. And so those sorts of things are already happening. And I think that, you know, like there's like a your digital afterlife, like digital legacy, like all these sorts of things are offering something similar to what you're describing, right? Like eventually something you can interact with. And I think it'll be hard to have it'll be hard for us to pass up on activating that kind of nostalgia if there's so much available to mine with machine learning such that it could pass for you for a little bit, especially if you have, say, a process to make it even more in line with your expectations. But this also raises a question of what does it mean to be interacting with a deceased, you know, a deceased recreation of someone that is in line with your expectations? Because the way that other people behave actually doesn't meet what we think about them, right? People aren't merely what we think about them, but we're also not what we think of ourselves. And so I could not, for instance, I think confidently program a version of myself to answer the way that I actually would in every situation, because other people know things about me that I don't know. And I think the same goes in reverse. Like, I don't know if someone else could program something that could do that because there's things about me that they don't know. And I think all that sort of adds up to, well, it adds up to, like, what are you doing that for? And I think our relationship to grief and mourning is going to be tested by the vast accumulation of data that's still coming, especially as more people start to think about how they could, say, offer this thing as a service.
Yeah, and I also think it says something about the way we think about social media. Like, I guess back in the day, social media just replaced like a phone, and a phone is just like you have your friend on the other end of it, and it's just like something in between you. But if you're creating a version of someone based on their social media profile, it's almost like that's a part of someone rather than just this kind of thing in between you for communicating.
It certainly is. And it also would be interesting to think about how much worse social media would be if they were thinking about how they would be reconstructed from it. So imagine that already people will kind of put out a fictional version of their lives that's much better than it really is in order to show that they're always having fun, right? Or, you know, they're a fun person, very interesting. And I think that would only get worse if you're thinking about, oh, like, well, if this is going to come out later, imagine, you know, all the Instagram influencers who were kind of recreated in their, how much more drastic would that come out in your personality if that's what you're reconstructed from, right? The part that's like, hey, look at me. And, you know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think also people have other parts of themselves that aren't on social media. But the fact that we have to kind of so carefully manage it and think about that is very telling, I think, already to the strangeness that we live in today. So for you, do you kind of see social media as kind of an extension of, well, like, of yourself at this point?
I definitely don't. I see it in more the kind of, it's a way to communicate. Like, I personally don't really use social media in that way. I use social media to message people. But I think that this use of technology implies something quite significant about the way we use technology.
I definitely agree.
So we've got all these technologies that transhumanists are talking about, reversing aging, cryogenics. And I think I'd like to push a little bit on this comparison with religion. So I'm going to apologize for any religious people listening, because I'm going to heavily simplify religion. So it's a little bit crude. But broadly speaking, we could analyze religions as an answer to the question, what happens when we die? And we could think about them as a way to avoid that there might simply be nothing when we die. So there's that point, and then because of that, it also gives meaning to our lives. So if we're going to go to hell, if we live a certain way, then it gives us a certain way to live in our lives. So it gives us also some kind of direction, as well as something that's going to come after we die. But transhumanism kind of turns that on its head. It's not an answer to the question, what happens when we die? It challenges the whole premise of that question, that we do have to die. And then the question that comes to my mind then is, where does the meaning and the direction come from? If that's one thing that religion does a really good job of, and a lot of people agree on that it gives us like an ethical code and things like that, then yeah, where does the whole meaning and the point of life come from?
It's interesting hearing you talk, because I hear a lot of existentialism. I don't know if that's the way you self-identify, but it reminds me a lot of kind of early 20th century conversations about, you know, life is kind of absurd, right? And we're going to die, right? And you know, how do we deal with that is a lot of what people are interested in. And so we could say that religion is, it has a mythologizing component to it, in which they create these stories about what's going to happen, you know, before and after life. And again, that's a very secular take, right? Like it doesn't actually go far enough in explaining if any of those stories are true. And I think that's an important limitation of secular study of religion, right? Is that it can't go far enough in investigating those things. But what happens with transhumanism, and why I think it's an important development from atheism, is because atheism has no intrinsic mission. If we consider that in the 1990s, early 2000s, the reason why atheists got lots of press is because they're pushing against a kind of mainstream Euro-American Christian sensibility. And, you know, there's lots of, especially here in America, especially against like evangelicals, there's plenty of people to be angry at, right? You can get into these really fiery debates about whether God exists, about whether there's a plan, you know, all these sorts of questions related to what you brought up, Patty. But once the atheists kind of get their point across, and I don't know, you have the development of Reddit and people just kind of, you know, aren't really interested in those questions anymore. And this is actually a really big part of understanding the religious climate, I think, today, which is a couple of years ago when I was actually going to visit the sorts of atheist, secular, agnostic organizations, at least here in Boston, they weren't well attended. No, nobody went to them. No one was interested in those sorts of questions. They've kind of accepted the, oh, well, maybe religion's true. Maybe it's nice if people believe that, but I don't know if it's really relevant to me. Right? That was kind of the sense that I got, was that most of the people involved, and again, were a bit older, right? They're part of a previous generation who was really combating a Christian impulse that they didn't like, right? Which they felt was false. But once that kind of wanes away, and it's not that people are like super Christian anymore or even super atheist, they're just apathetic about whatever is going to be happening. It's just like life is what it is, so to speak. And transhumanists actually come along and they provide a vision of the future that's energizing. If anything, we can say that this desire to create that immortal future gives people a purpose. And out of that purpose, right, you can create change, right? Like it's this opportunity for, it's a cause that people can get behind. And the problem with earlier atheist movements is that they're negative, right? They can only exist so long as there's something to fight, so to speak, right? It's like a, you know, it's like you can't have the Joker without Batman. That's kind of the way that the new atheist movement is. And so once, you know, one of those disappears, they kind of both disappear, because they exist in opposition to one another. But transhumanism doesn't need that because it has a mission. And, you know, we would say that, you know, they don't have these same sorts of stories of, you know, heaven and hell sorts of things, or even about the great karmic cycle or something like that, right? Like, I don't just want to pick on Christianity necessarily. But what they do have is they say, like, if you get involved, if you think about this now, there are real tangible consequences for your life in the future. It might be the case that if you really take care of yourself, if you advocate for these technologies, if you get involved in advocacy, perhaps you can really live longer. And because there's actually a mission there, it's something that people can do. It's not merely, you know, it's not merely like, oh, you know, like we know the Christians are wrong, or we know the Buddhists are wrong, or, you know, we know the Hindus are wrong, right? It's, oh, look, there's something we can do here. And it's that animating impulse that's where the religion is to me. It's not in these other sorts of components, the kind of mythological components, as you described, but rather in the animating components of being able to get people to believe in a vision of the future that may or may not be. And also, I think the other thing that makes it religious to me, especially as someone who used to be in the evangelical tradition, is, look, if you do stuff and you get other people to do this too, that's what's going to cause the change, right? So again, there's a proselytizing component to it. There's a hey, we need you to be getting out and making more transhumanists. There's, hey, we need to get everyone in society on board with this. And this is actually something you used to see in Christian eschatology with something called the post-millennial movement, which is that, whoa, if we actually got all of humanity on board with Christianity, then Jesus would finally come. We just haven't done our part yet. And they have kind of a similar idea in there. If we got everyone on board, then they would actually, then this would succeed. Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher at Oxford, has this thing called the fable of the dragon tyrant. So if we do want to talk about myths, I guess they do have at least one. And what this is, it's basically about of imagining death as a dragon, right? And that we have to feed the dragon arbitrarily every day with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people's lives. But if we would just see that the dragon can be beaten, right, and the dragon is death, then we wouldn't have to deal with the dragon anymore. People just wouldn't die. And the sooner we do that, the better it is for everyone. Because what if people die that we really care about along the way to us eradicating death? That's the point of the myth.
It's been a really fantastic conversation. And I just want to make, I mean, there's so much there that's really interesting. Very broadly speaking, we're talking about people who want to defy death. And that is, for all of human history, for all of natural history, part of life. Like, of all the technologies we can talk about that are hugely significant, this attempt to resist death, to me, seems like probably by far the most profound. Would you agree with that?
I definitely do agree with that. I think that efforts to stop death, I mean, you can even say that humans have been hugely successful in allowing a great majority of us to live longer than our ancestors would have. And we can see that in the ways in which, you know, most people like didn't even survive childbirth, right? Like, it was really hard to have children. Like, you know, both infant and maternal mortality used to be horrific. And so we have scientific advances already that have prevented, that have allowed people to live much, much longer than they would have otherwise. But to cause us not to die anymore is, I think, interesting even within the transhumanist perspective, because they're very pro-evolution, right? And that's one of the ways in which they distinguish themselves from something like evangelical Christianity. But the mechanism of evolution is death, right? Like, it is by virtue of the things that live on that change happens and is able to persist, right? It's because certain kinds of changes are advantageous in relationship to the environment. And so the traits that are not advantageous will die off. But if they're imagining a future of evolution without death, what does that mean exactly? I think that gets back to the autonomy angle of how is it that I can change myself to remain competitive with a changing world. And I think that there's also something potentially frightening about that. And I think there are other sorts of assumptions baked into this idea that we wouldn't die. Because, for instance, if I were to tell you, like, imagine that you would live forever, but there's one catch. Your life won't change, really. You'll have to keep working your 9 to 5. You know, you'll still be tired every day, right? When we think about living forever, there's kind of these unconscious assumptions that go into that beyond just the not dying part. And that's it has to be worth living for us to consider going forward. And so this is one of the other things I'm hoping to sort of develop is, how are these unconscious assumptions about a kind of heavenly scenario, right, that's really, really positive baked into this, such that it's not the case that I'm just dredging through my life as I feel like I'm doing right now. Because I don't think most people would actually even want immortality if it would mean that, hey, look, like, you're going to have to work your dead-end job, like, forever now. And we know you can't die, so you really have to do it. Okay, it's really important. I don't think that really appeals to anyone. But the thing that does appeal to people, And this is the thing that I think the transhumanists are actually offering is the, hey, like, you can live in a digital world. Like, imagine you lived in a Minecraft world where you could just do whatever you wanted. And you could only see the people that you want. You could bring up, like, resurrected versions of loved ones that you want. You have complete control over everything. You don't have to worry about everything, anything anymore. But even that assumes that there's some sort of, I don't know, machine overlord, like, protecting your digital world from, you know, because you're still on a server somewhere, presumably, right? Like, protecting that from being destroyed and making sure that it's still running. And I think that once, again, as you kind of, like, push on these things of, like, well, what do they actually look like? Of where did the benefits actually start to come in? It's it becomes a lot fuzzier because it's not clear how we would live that way and if that future would actually be beneficial unless machines were doing literally everything for us. But I think this goes back to even some of these other existential concerns of, well, why should I keep living then if I don't necessarily have a purpose, right? Like, what would our purpose be in a world that's like that? And I don't think any of us know. And we're still kind of grappling with that even today as, you know, fewer and fewer people do more and more of the kind of necessities, right? Like, fewer and fewer people are need to farm in order to feed everyone. But what does that say about people who feel like their working jobs actually don't matter? I think all this stuff's kind of interrelated to me, at least in my mind.
That's a really perfect note to end on. Thanks so much for joining us, Seth. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Patty.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Ethics for a Changing World. We'd be really interested to hear any thoughts you had on the episode, so feel free to send us a message on Twitter or Instagram, Twitter at EthicsTechPod and Instagram at Ethics for a Changing World. Or just tweet us and tag us. We'd be really interested to see what you think about all the different things that we've said today. And if you haven't checked out our two most recent episodes, which are about what it means to be human in the age of robots, then I think you'd be really interested to learn about those. And we've also got a new episode coming out next week about feminism and post-humanism, which contrasts in a quite interesting way with this episode. Remember to leave us a like and review, and to tell anyone who you think might be interested about the show. See you next time.